From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. After filmmaker Raoul Peck made his award-winning James Baldwin documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, he had a lot of suitors in Hollywood. But it was HBO that didn't blink when Peck explained what he wanted to do next.
On my contract, it was clearly stated, it's a film about colonization, extermination, and genocide. You know, that's one of the rare cases that you have those three words on the contract in Hollywood.
That evolved into a four-part series that zigs and zags through 700 years of colonial history. Peck tells us about blending archival footage, animation, home videos, and scripted sequences to create Exterminate All the Brutes, his very personal meditation on white supremacy through the ages. But first, we banter. Stay tuned. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So we have some streaming data we can parse over a little bit. Netflix had a miss. You know, it's funny. Netflix thought it was going to have 6 million new subscribers, didn't, got a little bit punished on Wall Street. And there's been some debate with certain people saying, my God, is this it? Has Disney Plus and HBO Max, have they changed the world? And is Netflix going to falter? And other people saying, oh, big deal. Netflix is still huge. Where do you come down?
I think a lot of this freak out is really overblown. I mean, if you look at the events of the past year, of course, Netflix growth is slowing. I mean, they've been impacted by the pandemic in the sense that their content pipeline has been slowed. So there weren't as many new shows in the past quarter. And what we know about Netflix is that it really benefits from having fresh new content. Secondly, they have a lot more competition over the past year than they've ever had before. I mean, they downplayed a little bit of this in their earnings call. But I mean, think of the things that didn't exist last year at this time: HBO Max, Paramount Plus, Peacock, Discovery Plus. None of these services is dominant, but they're all chipping away at that sense that Netflix is the 100-pound gorilla here. And we saw some growth from especially HBO Max, the numbers that were released in the past couple days. They had about 2.7 million new activations of HBO Max over the last quarter, which people are saying is decent. You know, you can debate whether it's worth putting their entire 2021 slate on the service day and date in order to get those numbers. But they're at least seeing some growth there. And that's not coming at the expense of Netflix, but it's at least putting a little bit more competition into the marketplace and making people think twice about what they're getting from Netflix.
I mean, look, at some point, it becomes very difficult. And this applies to AT&T and Warner Media, and therefore HBO Max as well. So the spend required for this is huge, unending. And so this to me, as I've said many times, you want to put everything into streaming. I don't know if that's a wise idea. Now, Netflix doesn't have other businesses, but these other people do. And I wouldn't be so keen to dump those businesses that can throw off a lot of revenue to completely focus on streaming, which is going to be like an addiction in terms of what it costs to maintain.
Yeah, Netflix said in their earnings call they're going to spend about $17 billion on content this year. And I remember when it was a big news headline that they were going to spend $5 billion. So where the ceiling is on what people are willing to spend to acquire subscribers is a big question. And a lot of companies are looking at it because I guarantee you Paramount Plus and Discovery Plus and Peacock, they are not spending $17 billion on their streaming service content.
Right. Let me switch to Scott Rudin. There's been some developments since we last talked about him. He had put out a statement. He said he was stepping away from Broadway productions. This is apparently after Sutton Foster, the star of Music Man, said behind the scenes that she was not going to be in the show if he didn't step away. And once he did, she put out a vague thing saying, things are good, this is better. That's basically what she said. You know, it's been a slow reaction. The town here in Hollywood and, you know, people who deal with talent on Broadway, there's a lot of them. There are those who have spoken out, notably Gail Ann Hurd, the producer, saying that this town is ignoring criminally abusive conduct, to use her words. But there's a lot of powerful players in Hollywood that do not want Scott Rudin to go away permanently and want a path back. And it doesn't even seem like he is looking for it so much because he has barely addressed that idea. He's sort of in the most vague terms said something about looking to do better, but this is going to be a huge challenge of how he finds his way back, except maybe not so huge because the town is dying to find it for him.
Yeah, I think there is a split, but you voiced a lot of those people this past week in a piece you wrote about how they are cautiously kind of saying, well, wait a second, are we going to cancel everybody? This guy has such amazing taste. It'd be a shame to lose him from the business, those kinds of comments. And it's a little perplexing to me because, you know, no, you're not going to cancel everybody, maybe just the people who are credibly accused of some really awful physical abuse. But it's interesting that the studios have not weighed in on this. The Producers Guild did put out a statement saying they're going to create a task force on bullying, but the studios have been silent. Most of the talent has been silent, especially people who work closely with Scott Rudin, including Frances McDormand, Aaron Sorkin, the Coen brothers, Wes Anderson, a lot of these high-end filmmakers. The studio A24, which is where Rudin has most of his projects now, they have been silent on this. There's been some background reporting about how they want him to step away from an upcoming Jennifer Lawrence project and a couple of others, but it's really unclear what that means. And I think everybody is kind of sitting around waiting, trying to figure out, okay, is Scott Rudin too radioactive? Is he someone that could come back after a well-placed statement from a crisis PR person? Does he have to go to rehab? Like, what do we have to do here?
Yeah, A24 sort of leaked, I think, I'm attributing to them, that his name will be taken off of several movies. Most of the big studios haven't wanted to do business with him in years. He is a very high maintenance proposition. So the studios have been out of that business also because he makes, you know, the kind of movies that I want to see, art house movies, serious movies mostly, and they're not in that business either. A24, I'm sure they're trying to figure out the path back. And on Broadway, he's backed by Barry Diller and David Geffen, two very volatile billionaires, both of whom have certainly yelled at me in the past, are not inclined to call out bullies and not in a position to call out bullies. And they have a lot of money. And the question is always talent. You know, the one thing that someone who was still in touch with Scott Rudin told me in this reporting, the story I just did for the Hollywood Reporter, was, you know, he's very concerned that the talent has to answer for him. And I'm not sure that's so much about his empathy for his wonderful relationships with the talent. I mean, I think it's because he knows where his Achilles heel is, and that is if the talent steps away.
Right. And all the things you just mentioned, the agency support, the awards magnets, the billionaire backers, the, you know, New York-based studio A24, all of these things are the infrastructure that allows this behavior to go unchecked for years and years. And we saw with the Harvey Weinstein thing, this is not on that level, of course, but the infrastructure around Harvey Weinstein is what allowed him to thrive in plain sight. And that is the same infrastructure that allowed Scott Rudin to thrive in plain sight. And it's cracking. And he knows that it's cracking because people are willing to come forward and say this stuff. And these talents are going to be asked about this. That's where he's going to be ultimately held accountable. And if more of these talents are not willing to work with him, then he will not be able to do what he does.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether to read it as arrogance or confusion that he has been so silent on what he will do to make amends for this behavior. I think a lot of people don't even know if there's anything he could do. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In his new HBO series, Exterminate All the Brutes, filmmaker and series narrator Raoul Peck wastes no time getting to the crux of the matter.
This is the origin of the ideology of white supremacy. Why do I bring myself into this story? Because I am an immigrant from a whole country. Neutrality is not an option.
Exterminate All the Brutes jumps around the world and goes forward and backward in time, tracing the history of white supremacy and genocide. Columbus, Hitler, and Trump all make appearances. Peck draws heavily on several books by historians, including one from Swedish author Sven Lindqvist, also called Exterminate All the Brutes. That phrase comes from the character of Kurtz in the Joseph Conrad novel, The Heart of Darkness. If that feels like a lot of historical and literary references, hang on, Peck is just getting started. He uses a range of film techniques, archival footage, clips from classic Hollywood movies, animations, and original live action sequences, and home video from Peck's own life. Born in Haiti, Peck moved to the Democratic Republic of the Congo as a child and then to New York before going to film school in Berlin. Peck joined us in person in 2016 to talk about his Oscar-nominated documentary, I Am Not Your Negro, which explored racism in the United States through the writings of James Baldwin. This time, he spoke to us from the south of France. So did I Am Not Your Negro, do you think, did that make this possible?
Organically for me, yes. In terms of the artistic approach and even the possibility of it. Now, I gathered that your question was more in terms of, of financial capacity.
The cold business thing.
Yes and no. Yes and no. Of course, as it usually in our industry, when you have a success, everybody wants to see you. But my approach was always to make the film I want to make. So it's always about finding partners who are willing to go into these projects I want. Of course, I was sent multiple numbers of screenplays and projects and at different stages. But for me, that's not really something I want to do. But because of my track record, or because I'm simply old enough in this industry, I also have friends and allies and people I've worked with, people who know or and respect my work, and with whom I can have a certain conversation. In that particular case, it was Richard Pepler, the head of HBO at the time, the president of HBO, who I knew from, 20, 25 years ago. So we had a track record. So Richard Pepler was among the people who invited me to sit down and just talk and see, what would be my next project. And I was very candid and very open. And I say, at that stage, I am mostly exhausted from I Am Not Your Negro. And that I basically need time to think and to even, to see if any other film made sense to me. And in particular, because I knew that I Am Not Your Negro was supposed to be a big blow to every discussion about race, justice, democracy, etc. And even the critic of capitalism. So I didn't know how you could do that better than James Baldwin have done.
Right.
So in the discussion we came about, I said, I need time. I need maybe money to pay some researcher and to think. And basically he said, well, you can have all that.
Yeah, I read that and it reminded me of the famous Virginia Woolf, the room of one's own, the space to create. It's pretty extraordinary, right?
Exactly.
To be given that. Yeah.
And it's very rare in our industry, And because of the nature of the project, I didn't have to write any particular scenario or screenplay, because it's a film that you have to make while making it.
Yes.
You start very early on archive, on writing, on research, and as well on the editing table. That's how I somehow get a totally free rein. I was able to move on the project as it was being made. It's a kind of freedom that you rarely have and that really profit the project.
So when Richard Pepler says to you, what do you want to do? And you say, I want to do a massive, very imaginative project meditation on white supremacy? What did you tell him?
Well, there were steps. And the next step, I guess, was I had already the notion to use Sven Lindqvist's book, Exterminate All the Brutes. And I sent the book to HBO and said, well, I think I can start building around that. And that was it. So, on my contract, it was clearly stated, it's a film about colonization, extermination, and genocide. That's one of the rare cases that you have those three words on the contract in Hollywood.
Yes, I'm not laughing at the subject matter, to be clear. I'm just laughing at the idea of somebody saying, let's do that,
Well, that's the saying, All along my career, I was lucky to find certain allies, That's why I'm against sometimes this, say, well, you can't do this with a studio, you can't do that. It's a matter of the kind of relationship you develop. You know, those are human beings within, of course, a capitalistic structure. But there are sometimes cracks. There are sometimes moments in time and history where some projects are possible because the attention is not specifically on that corner. You know, they have so much bigger things to take care of. You know, there is a tremendous run to get as much audience, as much client as possible globally, because there will be, the next fight will be, you know, who will survive? Because obviously, you know, not everybody will survive.
It appears not. And speaking of the survival issue, you know, there are massive changes at Warner Brothers and Warner Media. And Richard Plepler was not in the in his same job while you were completing your project. How did that work for you or not work?
Well, you know, HBO somehow is a different studio, I would say. For a long time, they have been called themselves a family. So once he left, the project was already well underway. Mm-hmm. So there was basically nobody who could really enter, you know, the citadel of this project, you know. So everything was, I would say, already on the table.
So the series is 4-hour-long episodes, which was, I read somewhere it was going to be 15.
No. It was never going to be 15. I was just explaining my process. And the way I work is to get everything out that I feel is important, that I resonate with, that makes sense to me, that touches me, and put them in a first draft of a, you know, dramatic structure, you know. Mm-hmm. And the result of that was on all the walls where I hanged all the my clips was about, you know, 15 episodes. But I went through that process before, and so I did not panic because I knew it's just a step. It's really a process where you have to go from everything first, and then you cut out.
I imagine a lot in the editing room, you move from place to place. It's almost something that is a relief as you're dealing with a very horrible story. It's like, let's go to another horrible story because we're not still in this space. I don't know if that was deliberate or not.
Well, first of all, I am not alone. I had you know, a great team, and they knew what they have to do. So I don't feel that all the time the pressure is only on me. You know, I'm most more like, I feel like I am the music coordinator, and I make sure that all the instruments play together. Of course, the writing mostly and big part of the editing is on my shoulder and Alexandra Strauss' shoulders, who she's the editor. But, you know, there is the group that work on the animation. There is the group who works on the narrative. There is another group who works on the archive. So it's really a team effort. And basically, they are protecting me as well, because I need to have a clear brand in order to really keep my sanity and keep, you know, the vision of the whole thing. So it took us almost basically 3 years to make.
Coming up after a short break, Exterminate All the Brutes director Raoul Peck explains how he got All-American actor Josh Hartnett to play a racist murderer through the ages. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to filmmaker Raoul Peck about his new HBO series, Exterminate All the Brutes. The 4-part documentary explores white supremacy and genocide. Peck narrates the series and uses a blend of archival footage, animations, home movies, and live-action sequences featuring Josh Hartnett as a kind of everyman racist murderer who participates in atrocities over the course of centuries.
I did not want to spill Seminole blood. Kill Seminole children, Seminole women. Give us back the American property you stole from our good fellowmen, planters, and settlers, and I let you move to the Indian territory the U.S. government has provided for your people.
Hartnett's character is often just following orders, but he doesn't hesitate to kill. For Peck, casting this key part in his series began as a process of elimination.
You know, there are the usual suspects. You know, there are actors who play the bad guys. I knew from the start that's not what I wanted. I needed somebody who was clearly American. You know, mm-hmm. the perfect American, genuine white man. And you don't think of Josh as being the bad guy. Right. On the contrary, you rather think of him as the good guy. And it was important that at all time during the whole four episodes that we see him as a human being and not just as a crazy bastard. And the choice of Josh was, of course, important in that. And that's also a conversation that was easier for me to have with Josh, whom I knew for more than 20 years now, than with an actor that I who I didn't know. Josh is also a very political person. That's unfortunately what most Hollywood sometimes don't know. You know, they just see the star, but he's somebody who is involved. So he who understands the world, who traveled. There is a good reason why he left Hollywood at some point, you know. So I knew who I was dealing with and who I could ask that.
Yes.
And there could not be any cheating in it, you know. He had to be sincerely full force into the role. Other actors would have played it perfectly, but from a notion that I am playing a bad guy, so I am better than this bad guy. Mm-hmm. That I didn't want.
And I noticed the long clip in your film from old movies, notable, especially the On the Town.
I really love Tom Tom.
And I have to say, yes, you know, I grew up, we all grew up watching some of those old movies. And when you rewatch them, it's like a slap in the face to see that stuff, which maybe in the past we were, you know, seduced into not necessarily. I mean,
That's the power of Hollywood. And it's hard to counter that. You know, we are all infected by it and globally. In Haiti, in Congo, everywhere I was, you know, I was nurtured by that, those films. And the only difference is that through my education, through the fact that I came from Haiti, a country which is very aware of its history, I knew to make the difference. I knew to see when it was about me. I knew to watch the guy who was being killed as myself. You know, yes. I never, and very early on in my life, I never laughed with everybody, mm-hmm. you know, and that was a sort of, you know, very critical eye toward Hollywood. You know, I could indulge and have fun watching a Western, but I always saw the Native American as closer to me than John Wayne, you know.
Yes.
So I grew up with that.
Let me, you know, we're at a moment where, in many ways, the streaming services are opening things up to filmmakers from other cultures, other countries, diverse races, you know, things that might certainly wouldn't have gotten made, I would say, you know, if in the old school way of doing business, this with their appetite for content, you know, we're seeing opportunity. But at the same time, I have to ask you as someone
very
aware.
You're very optimistic.
Well, to some degree it has. I mean, we've seen things like 13th or, you know, or White Tiger.
Yes, but, you know, if you watch back a lot of, I would say, more progressive production, they were there. They, of course, did not have that wider distribution.
Right.
But then they had their ways to go over, around the world. You know, I've seen those films when I was young, so they existed. But now, even though you said, indeed, there seems to be wider opportunity to make certain films, but don't underestimate the confusion that exists as well, you know. For a young person today to click on 13 and not on the 100 thousands of stuff that are easier to watch.
True.
It asks a lot of energy.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
You have to have some sort of, you know, rationality about the world as it is right now. You know, anything that is being promoted because of profit, you have to be suspect. You know, the technology right now, I'm old enough to have seen the beginning of the internet. And I remember it was a great time because it was still in the university playground. It was incredible, a lot, and you had access to really new knowledges. And I remember the day AOL came out and that you had to pay to have access. I knew it was finished. I knew it was finished. And it became what it came, a monster that nobody controls, you know, or basically five guys control, you know. So we have to question the consequences. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, well, that's the point I was trying to touch on. We see something like the government of China, which has got its own genocide going on, leaning on streamers, or with the Hasan Minhaj, with the Patriot Act. Yeah. They are, you know, the Saudis leaning on content providers to censor. And I wonder,
of course,
since you didn't accept my initial premise, I suppose you're just going to, you'll say, yep, it's all bad. But that's what I was going to ask you about.
Yeah, well, it's complicated. You know, it's like progress, or what they call progress, is always two-sided. You know, of course, I like to have an iPhone because it enables me to do a lot. But at the same time, it's also creating a lot of new problems. It's always about what the society does with the technology, you know? And yes, many times we did not control that technology. Because as long or as soon as it is for profit, we need to be suspect, because profit cannot build societies. Profit build profit. That's all it does. And destroy societies and destroy communities. And we have, you know, we live that every day. Even when somebody like Trump say, well, we are losing our jobs to China. Yes, but that's capitalism. That's how you made your money. So you can't have it both ways, you know. It has consequence. Once your decision is a decision made for the purpose of making more money, you are in trouble. Or at least not you, a lot of other people are in trouble. And that's the situation right now.
Let me ask you, after this very massive, daunting project, do you have something else on your plans right now? Or is there an idea that is percolating?
I can tell you there are at least three screenplays that are already written. So it's too early to tell much more about it. But yeah, I have so many open books and so many open projects, you know, and they become ripe, as you know, when they need to. And I had, you know, throughout the last 3 years, I had a deal with Amazon, I had a deal with HBO, and now I have a deal with another studio. So, you know, those were projects that I worked on while I was making Exterminate All the Brutes. It's never just one project, otherwise we would be dead in the picture.
Well, we'll wait and see what that is. Let me just say this. Raoul Peck is the director of Exterminate All the Brutes, now on HBO Max. Thank you for joining us from the south of France. Next time I will join you there. That's my plan.
Well, you're welcome. You're welcome.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Desmond Taylor. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.